Rita Nakashima Brock describes herself as a citizen of the world. Born in Japan, she came to the United States at age 6 and attended grammar school in East Kansas during the 1950s. For those of you that don't know about Kansas, it's located in the middle part of our United States. And during the 1950s, represented an area that was predominantly white and had very traditional values. Rita's mother was Japanese and her stepfather was white. Part of her growing up struggle centered on role models and a complete absence of information about her culture. She engaged in a constant search for her bicultural identity in order to make sense of her life experience. Growing up in a military family meant that she moved a lot, Japan, Europe, the United States. This gave a sense of rootlessness and no place to call home. Out of this experience came a profound sense of her life as part of the world, a global citizen. About 10 years ago, she discovered her birth father was Puerto Rican. This knowledge has added a whole new dimension of self as a citizen of the world. High school was spent proving that she was an all-American girl, a cheerleader, an honor student, a school leader. Her world changed when she attended college in Southern California. For the first time, she encountered militant Asian Americans and a yellow power group, and the politics of race became part of her experience. This was a transforming moment in Rita's life. Her story is this. During the time that I was 10 to 14 years old, I had a recurring dream with many variations. I wanted my mother to teach me Japanese. She would not. The communists, in the 50s, they were the bad guys. The communists kidnapped my mother and had taken her someplace. I tried to find her and I found myself running through a dark, dense forest, looking for my mother. When I found her, she was locked inside of a strange house. The doors and the windows were locked. I could see inside and I began knocking at the window and she would look up, but she would not see me. I would then run back through the woods to where we lived to try and get someone to come with me to help. Rita is still running through the forest looking for her mother.
Twelve years ago, when I was working on this degree that's the permanent head damage degree Kim Kyung mentioned, I had just gone through my grueling qualifying exams and felt like a survivor. I'd gone out jogging with a bunch of friends and arrived at the School of Theology grounds in Claremont kind of sweaty and tired. And this beautiful young woman came running up to me and said, "Are you Rita Brock?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Oh, my name is Jung Hyun Kyung. I'm from Korea. I came to study theology and I want to be a famous feminist theologian, just like you." And I remember thinking at the time, if I'm a famous feminist theologian, we have a long way to go. And I think today is a witness to how far we have come. I'm calling my lecture Reflections on Mirrors, Mother Root, and Memory. Barbara D'Souza worked for almost 8 years among poor communities in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and developed a 2-year course in health education for the women there. The area she worked in had only one public health clinic for over 80,000 people. Barbara provided basic healthcare information and instructions on how to do community health work. The women gathered weekly to learn anatomy from the head down, learning about the illnesses of the various systems and how to treat them, and also about the politics of healthcare in Brazil. To help them learn, she had her classes create a life-size doll on which they put all the correct anatomical features. Barbara also had them draw posters. A peak moment during the course was reached about after a year of instruction when they studied the reproductive system. The women lost their inhibitions with each other and developed a group spirit, she says. In the act of learning how their bodies worked, the women came to what Barbara describes as a spiritual awakening. And she says, "It is at this midpoint that they can feel the power and beauty of their reproductive system as women. Then the image of God includes their image, that of creation, creating a new being, and God is also feminine." Now remember, she says, this is not a theology course, but a health course. Yet it became obvious to me after years of experience that women cannot discuss their bodies, learn the beauty of them, without theology entering, a questioning of the patriarchal system, not only of the church, but of all society. And with this comes the questioning of the lack of control they have in this system over their own bodies, the questioning of who is responsible for their feelings of guilt and shame when it comes to knowing and enjoying these bodies. One woman's story stands out from the others, and I have Barbara's permission to tell it. Donna Julieta was from an abusive marriage, could not handle money, and was unable to do anything outside her home without her husband's permission. She believed she was stupid, slow, and unable to learn. In order to come to the meeting, she told her husband she was attending a prayer meeting at church, and she had to bring her 7-year-old daughter along. As the weeks proceeded, it became evident that she was able slowly to learn. Though she could barely read, she was good at spatial relationships and made well-organized posters. She was also a lively member of the group in supporting and cheering on others as they all struggled to learn the new material. At the time of the peak of the course, Julieta's husband said to her that he was tired of her going to prayer class every Wednesday. He beat her and forbid her to go by locking her in the bedroom. When she didn't show up that week, the group was worried and discussed what they could do, but since her husband was abusive and unfriendly, they decided it would make matters worse to go to her house. The next Wednesday, when Julieta's husband saw her whispering to her daughter, he suspected something, so he repeated that she was not to go. Her daughter, to be helpful, said, "But Papa, they don't really pray at these meetings. They look at this big naked doll and talk about it." Furious, he beat her and locked her in her room again. But Julieta had had a taste of feeling loved and important, so she climbed out the window and went. She told the group that as a child, she had been passed from one member of her family to another because her mother died in childbirth. No one cared for her because she was plump and shy. She felt ugly and useless. She hated mirrors all her life, because when she looked at them, she saw someone ugly and stupid. But she told the group, "Now when I look in the mirror, I see someone I love." The whole group cried, and began to tell stories of their own years of oppression. They ended that meeting by praying together for strength to continue toward a time when they could love themselves as made in God's image, the image in the mirror. What reimagining of God, what reimagining would allow us to look in a mirror and say that we see in our embodied whole selves someone we love? How can divine images affirm the complex, ambiguous, often difficult lives of women all over the world who swim in the riptides of oppressive systems? How can we come to understand our daily, ordinary, earthbound acts of care, our emotionally charged, demanding relationships, our solitary, reflective moments, our work for our societies, for our churches, for each other, and for our life on the earth, and our very physical selves as images of sacred power, of God with us and in us, in our very flesh? Nancy Mayers, an American Catholic feminist who struggles to live with multiple sclerosis, opens her spiritual autobiography, Ordinary Time, by declaring that God is here, and here, and here, and here. Not an immutable entity detached from time, but a continual calling and coming into being. Not transcendence, that orgy of self-alienation beloved of the fathers, but immanence, God working out God's self in everything, the holy as verb, what she does, how she does it. Mayers invites us to plunge ever deeper into our very flesh, our existence as matter, the same root as mother, mater, the growing trunk of a tree. To explore our earthbound lives, we must look, as Mayers says, where we are needed. The life-giving power of women is this seeing of sacred power in ordinary, needful acts, in daily care, persistent presence, and embodied loving. Marilu Awiakta's poem, Mother Root, describes this sacred power. Creation often needs two hearts, one to root and one to bloom, one to sustain in time of drought and hold fast against the winds of pain, the fragile blossom that in the glory of its hour affirms a heart unsung, unseen. And what images will open our own eyes, so long clouded by patriarchal ideas and images? What enables us to touch, to smell, to see here and here and here and here the presence of God, the mother root? What will help us to see in the mirror an image of God to love? Three theological principles guide the following journey into reimagining God. First, incarnation, which compels us to look within ordinary earthbound existence for clues to divine presence within the humble lives of those, in Adrian Rich's words, who age after age perversely with no extraordinary power reconstitute the world. Looking for incarnation as a verb is to look for the activity, not the individual, in which love is manifest. For the Spirit of God in our midst moves fluidly, finding homes for her presence as hearts open, looking elsewhere as hearts close. The revelation of incarnate spirit comes from the margins of life, from the heart of life-giving power, from Mother Root. The second principle is Emmanuel, images of the God who is with us in the ambiguous realities of our lives, not in the idealized realm of one-dimensional heroes and sanitized saviors, but in the messy middle of life lived on a daily basis. We need images of lives that touch deeply into our own pain and struggle, a touching which at its most powerful points to God with us, Emmanuel. The third principle is ecclesia, from ek, out, and kalein, to call. Ecclesia means to call out, to summon together into an assembly. It is grounded in the Christian confession that God is love and we are to love one another. We must look for images that bind us to each other more strongly in communities struggling for justice, for wholeness within ourselves, with each other, and with the earth, for passionate, committed loving. We must look to images that help us resist disconnection, alienation, denial, and apathy. For we need each other beyond all speaking and more deeply than we know, at the core of our deepest mother root, in our very body selves, as ecclesia. And so I offer images for these three principles, incarnation, Emmanuel, and ecclesia. For incarnation, I begin with an old story. Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and a Canaanite woman from those parts came out crying, "Sir, have pity on me, son of David, my daughter is tormented by a demon." But he said not a word in reply. His disciples came and urged him, "Send her away and see how she comes shouting. See how she comes shouting after us." Jesus replied, "I was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and to them alone." But the woman came and fell at his feet and cried, "Help me, sir." To this Jesus replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." "True, sir," she answered. "And yet the dogs eat the scraps that fall from their master's table." Hearing this, Jesus replied, "Woman, what faith you have, be it as you wish." And from that moment, her daughter was restored to health. This is a story of a woman with no extraordinary power. The disciples find her persistence obnoxious. And even Jesus is rude to her. She, however, will not be deterred. She has courage and audacity in the face of their rejection. What my friend Rebecca Parker calls mother bear energy, fiercely protecting her child. She gives Jesus a smart retort and wins the argument. I think she's the only person in the Bible to win an argument with Jesus. She gets Jesus to concede, I believe, because she shifts the focus of the debate away from her own status as outsider and toward Jesus' responsibility for his power. Jesus refuses her because she is outside his people. "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she replies, "Yet the dogs eat the scraps that fall from the master's table." In other words, "So what if I am a Gentile? Have you so little compassion that you cannot help me?" She turns the tables. The transformative power of love comes from the marginal, from those abused by the powers of domination and injustice who demand responsibility from the powerful. When Jesus is oppressed by the principalities and powers of the world, he reveals the incarnate power of God, as he does through much of his life and at his death. But when Jesus has structural power over another, marginalizes her, divine power confronts Jesus from those margins. In other words, she is the incarnation of God to Jesus. Jesus acknowledges this revelation when it happens with the words, "Woman, what faith you have, be it as you wish." And often with the marginalized, he says to them, "Not I have made you whole, but your faith has made you whole." And this is how the transformative power of God is incarnated here and here and here and here. The power of Mother Root. If we are concerned with the status of victims, we are prevented from facing squarely the misuse of power, which is always wrong, regardless of the status of the victim. This is a lesson churches who would be in solidarity with women must learn. Women must be included in all decision-making capacities and leadership roles of the church, not because we can do things like men, or better than men, though that is often not difficult, but because the marginalization and disenfranchisement of any group by another within the church is a corrupt abuse of power. To take responsibility for power and to find incarnation, we must understand the ambiguities of life in this world. To exist at all is to have some power to hurt others. Even a fetus has power to affect the life of its mother. And infant children do things that drive parents to distraction. No living thing is totally without power. We must not be confused living life in the messy middle of things. Those who have power must understand their power and take responsibility where they can for preventing harm to others. Period. In the web of complex relationships in which we live, each of us finds ourselves in both positions, sometimes hurt, sometimes able to cause hurt. It is up to us to be alert to our own uses of power so that we are able to resist abuse and to resist abusing, to resist oppression and to refuse oppressing others. For remember, incarnation is an activity, God as verb, not a state of being. When we take responsibility, we can use our power to love, to nurture, to enable freedom and willfulness of others, incarnating the love of God. In taking responsibility, we can say that the incarnation of God is here and here and here and here, working where she is needed, where we are needed. The activity of incarnation is what Audre Lorde has called erotic power at work. The Canaanite woman loves her daughter against all odds. Hers is neither a sweet, sentimental love, quiet and passive, nor an objective love, unself-invested and detached, but a fierce love that stands against the powers that thwart her passion for healing and wholeness. This is the power of God reaching out from the margins, the power of Mother Root. She does not allow her need for approval or respectability to interfere with her need to keep her daughter alive. The Canaanite woman's daughter is possessed of a terrible demon. What does it mean to be possessed of a demon? It means we have lost ourselves. Our psyches have split themselves off from our flesh, from our bodily home, and wander lonely and afraid. We no longer possess conscious control of our own behavior and have lost our capacity for incarnation. Our psyches have become subject to powers too painful to resist. In children, such demons are named emotional abuse, molestation, rape, physical violence. Possession is the sign of soul murder happening in a child. The Canaanite woman is fighting for the soul of her daughter, for the return of her daughter's incarnation of God to her. As we are fighting for the soul of the church, too long possessed by patriarchy. Millions of the world's women have lived out fierce commitments at great risk to themselves, perversely persisting against all odds. Erotic power, God incarnate, enters into life through the work of ordinary women, through our struggles and vulnerabilities. That power is born in our passion for physical and spiritual healing and wholeness. It is found in our protective embracing of relationships against powers of control and violence and death. Our passions feed mother root, without which no society can survive. The second image of God I propose, Emmanuel, is contained in a story the ethicist Sarah Ruddick tells of a mother named Julie, whose first child is born colicky and difficult. For 4 months, the baby slept for no more than 1 hour at a time, and for six more, she slept only 2 hours. Like many mothers in male-dominated industrial societies, Julie spent hours alone with her baby, day and night. Her husband, a struggling student, was often away studying and working. Day and night, Julie helplessly paced the floor as her beloved baby gasped for air. Sleep deprivation drove her mad. One night, alone in her dreams, Julie heard the baby screaming, only to awaken to the reality of that awful sound. In her own words, Julie says, "I stumble towards your room and switch on the low lamp so the light will not startle you. You wail and call. Trembling, I walk to your bed and check your diaper. I try to speak, to soothe, to give voice to my presence, but my throat constricts in silent screaming, and I find I cannot touch your tangled blanket. I force myself to turn and walk away, leaning against the door jamb. My knees buckle beneath me, and I find myself huddled on the floor. Please do not cry, oh child I love. Please do not cry. Tonight you can breathe, so let me breathe. And I realize my chest is locked, and I am gasping for breath. I picture myself walking towards you, lifting your tininess in both my hands and flinging you at the window. Mixed with my choking, I can almost hear the glass as it would smash. And I see your body, your perfect body, swirl through the air and land 3 stories below on the pavement." Sick from this vision, Julie vomits, changes her baby's diaper, and barricades the nursery door against herself. Later the same night, she wraps the daughter in blankets, carries her down the stairs, and rides the bus all night long, thinking her child would be safe with her if they were not alone. In a society that neither values nor supports her commitment to her child's well-being, Julie struggles to keep her child alive. Despite having reached her own breaking point, she summons the energy to protect her child's life and preserve their bond, even when the enemy is her own exhaustion. Julie did all she could to keep her child alive and safe. What she did was enough. In the midst of despair closing in on her, her love for her baby was enough. The blankets and her arms are a mother's compassionate embrace, riding the bus all night long. The embrace of God with us, all night long. Emmanuel. And she is one of millions of mothers in places like Mogadishu, Managua, Manila, Moscow, and Minneapolis, who struggle against hunger and malnutrition, AIDS, abandonment, domestic violence, political repression, racism, and war, who struggle body and soul to protect and nurture life. Sometimes they sell their very own flesh to keep themselves and their babies alive. Sometimes they fail and grieve the losses. And sometimes knowing when to let go is part of life's wisdom. Nonetheless, millions of women persist perversely against a myriad of destructive principalities and powers. And this is an image of God who rides the bus all night long, who is with us in our suffering and struggle, in the messy middle of our lives, Emmanuel. Such acts of loving are lived out also by those of us who are not biological mothers. I am not a biological mother, but I care about the fate of our world and its people, especially its children. Anyone who has struggled to reduce the suffering in our world has probably at some point felt that raw edge of exhaustion and hopelessness. Our experiences of tragedy and evil may drive us to the brink of despair. If we care at all, we will feel pain over and over. Hostility to children and to women in the world is rising, as is evident in the escalation of child prostitution and the growing sex industries around the world. Values such as loving care and interdependence in industrial and post-industrial societies are in grave danger as multinational capitalism continues to spread like an epidemic. And an increasing number of women struggle in the two-thirds world under a myriad of dire circumstances. It is miraculous that so many of us still make commitments to care for each other and our children and honor those commitments. And these are commitments that must be made by everyone, including fathers. Saving our difficult world from its destruction requires our fiercest, most committed loving from women and men. The passion of such love is governed by a commitment that perseveres persistently through all the crazy feelings we may experience. This commitment is Emmanuel, indeed, the pain and joy of Mother Root. I suggest one final image of God drawn from the story of my own life. As Kathy said, a decade ago, I learned that I had a Puerto Rican birth father. When my Japanese mother passed away 10 years ago, she left behind adoption papers that I found. They contained no information about my lost father. Through a series of bizarre coincidences, accidents, and searching, I discovered his name and an old address in Dorado, Puerto Rico. I went there to find what I could, not knowing if he knew anything about me, or if he was alive, or why I was such a secret. I found 10 aunts and uncles and many cousins who had hoped that I would be found someday. My father, who left for Korea when I was 6 months old, had not contacted my mother for 2 years. He was living in New York. My mother, after 2 years of silence from him, had cut all contact, which is why I did not know of him. So I met him later. In that visit to Puerto Rico, I found grandparents, a grandfather who prayed every night before he slept that he would see his first grandchild before he died. My grandmother did not pray. She was sure this child she loved only from a few faded baby pictures would someday be found. She was so sure I would come that she had pasted those pictures to her dresser mirror where she peered expectantly at them for 33 years. And my abuela Maria was right. I arrived unexpectedly one winter looking for a family I wasn't sure existed. It never occurred to me that they would be waiting for me with open arms. I was amazed to learn that a grandmother, whom I did not know and who knew me only from faded photographs, cared passionately that I would be well and that I would return. My grandmother's commitment to loving me did not rest on my knowing her, but on her memory of me. Abuela Maria loved me, though she was unknown to me. To be loved, even when we do not know we are being loved, is the power of ecclesia in our lives, to be called out by those who care. And this ecclesia of mother root comes through flesh, through the legacies of bodies of our people who enfold us in a vast circle of kinship and care. Belonging to generations of a people creates a huge sea of memory that nurtures hope and love. This sea surrounds us with people who did not know us and whom we may never know. The imaginations and promises of generations of grandmothers and grandfathers who have called us out and remain in the memory of our legacies. God, hear, and hear, and hear, and hear. Ecclesia. To be a citizen of the world without generations of memory to anchor us to her story and to the earth is to float without patterns, without dreams, without meaning, without ecclesia. Without a people and their legacies, we live without those who made miracles and kept their promises, without those who held fast against winds of pain. For each of us, there have been thousands of people over many centuries and across many miles who have loved us without knowing us, hearts unsung, unseen. Their hopes and dreams for the future, their hard, gritty clinging to life, sometimes against all odds, is their work to keep life going, to hold fast to the bonds of love and care. No one protecting the gossamer tendrils of love's fragile blooms can survive without ecclesia. And through our hopes and dreams, holding our to life against all odds, we too pass on this legacy of loving to those who will never know us. Because I was adopted by a stepfather, I have been given an additional legacy. It binds me to many other adoptees who struggle to understand the legacies brought to us by the suffering of our biological parents. Without people to belong to, whether through birth or adoption, without those people whose hopes are like faded photographs on a dresser mirror peered at expectantly, the world is a cold, lonely and hopeless place. But ecclesia is not easy. While the world without ecclesia may be lonely, the legacy of our peoples includes the ghosts of those who loved us, who are angels, as well as the ghosts of those who murdered souls, who are demons. To have a people means to inherit an ambiguous historical legacy, an enfleshed reality passed body to body, incarnate spirit to incarnate spirit, heart to heart, truth and pain grounded in earthly life. For all its ambiguities and tragedies, this affirmation of ecclesia is why my life is tied to the church. Church that is defined in the broadest sense possible, which includes the wild women, the marginalized, and the heretics, as well as the patriarchs. In the church, I have a legacy of the lives of ordinary women, To live with integrity within that highly ambiguous legacy, we must listen to the angels and the demons. Without a people, we have no healing presence in our lives, no incarnate spiritual legacy. We have no solidarity in our suffering, no Emmanuel, and we have no context of meaning within which to shape a life, no ecclesia. As we struggle with incarnation, Emmanuel, and ecclesia, we must continue to peer into the mirror and say, I see someone I love. In case you were wondering, Donna Julieta continued to attend the health course. She sometimes came late and teary-eyed, but she came. She also summoned the courage to give a Blood Pressure Awareness Day lecture in church, educating everyone about the control of high blood pressure, which affects about 50% of the Brazilian population. She took over 100 blood pressures. Someone in the congregation told her husband of her work in such glowing terms that he asked her to take his blood pressure and his mother's and two friends. She finished the whole two-year course. Creation often needs two hearts, one to root and one to flower, one to sustain in time of drought, and hold fast against the winds of pain the fragile bloom that in its hour affirms a heart unsung, unseen. Mother Root in the mirror, let us remember and celebrate her here and here and here and here. Amen.